yata bhutam nyanya dasana. And personally, I never heard about it until a few months ago, maybe a year ago now. I was talking to someone, having a phone interview, and she had pain. And so I said to her, well, maybe you could do this, you could do that. And she said, no, I can't do anything. I must accept things as they are, because that is the way of the Buddha. And I thought, I mean, I know this expression. We hear it a lot in spiritual circle, in Buddhist meditation circle. Be with things as they are. But I was not so sure about that, because I thought, but this does not fit with the four great efforts, which is one of the Eightfold Path, which tells you, you know, to do something about things, to creatively engage with condition. So I thought, this must be a New Age thing. You know, this is not from the Buddha. This must be, you know, a New Age popular saying, be with things as they are. Until I consulted with Stephen, who know more than me about these things. And he said, no. Actually, Goenka says it a lot. And it is in the text. It's in the Pali text. But not as it's popularly known. This is a thing. And that's why it's so important to know the whole thing. Yata bhutam, nyanya dasana. And that's how I discovered it. So, being curious about this, yata bhutam, nyanya dasana, I wrote to my friends, because I'm very lucky to have scholarly friends, Bhikkhu Bodhi, John Peacock, Andrew Elinsky, people like that. And so I said, how would you translate yata bhutam nyanya dasana? And what each means. And actually, it shows that it's more complicated than just accept things as they are. So, yata. Yata means as, according to. Bhutam means fact, actuality, real, or it can mean born, produced, grow, become. Nyanya means knowledge. Dasana means seeing, vision. So basically, all together, it means the knowledge and vision that accords with actuality, with what is real, or with how things come to be. So this gets a little more complicated than just accept things as they are. Because you see, with be with things as they are, we could think it means, like my friend thought, just endure, don't change anything, accept, do not do anything. But I don't think that's what it means. Because in a way, here you're saying, this is the way it is, you cannot change it. And then you move from that, you must not change it. But in a way, it's saying, in a short way, to know and to see things as they occur, as they come to be, as they happen. So already it starts to be a little more processual instead of just as they are. And you could take as they are in two ways. In a kind of experiential way, this is the way it is, or in a mystical way. And then you would have to find how truly, truly things are. With that, I think is a bit complicated, as different people have different ideas about that one. So basically, here it's saying more the knowledge and vision that occurs with how things come to be. And then this knowledge and vision is in a way about the five aggregates and the three characteristics. So basically, it's getting involved in our conditions. So it's not something to just accept, but it's actually to creatively engage with conditions as they occur, inner conditions, outer conditions. And so if we look at these five aggregates, the idea that we are made of a composite, again, we can always analyze and divide in many different ways. But to me, what is most interesting about the five aggregates is that actually it means we are a composite. We are made up of different conditions. So what it means is that we cannot reduce ourselves to any one of the conditions that forms us. Because often that's what we do. We have a thought, we reduce to the thought. We have a feeling, we reduce to the feeling. And then the more we grasp at the feeling, the thought, or the sensation, or the event, then the more we, in a way, reduce our vista to that. And then we think, in a way, our life is just about this, that we must solve this thought or this problem. And if we can't, you have the feeling your life is finished. And I think this knowledge and vision in connection to the aggregates is actually to see that we made of a flow of condition. And so in a way, to see that the meditation becomes this exploration of the condition that forms us. Inner conditions meeting outer conditions. And then I think this becomes really, in a way, fun. It's not just that's how it is, can't change it. But it's more how do these things come together? How do they arise? How do they stay? How do they pass away? How much action do I have on them, or no action do I have on them? Because I think in a way, sometimes, of course, we cannot do much. Like if many years ago, I had a friend who was dying of leukemia, and we used to visit him in the hospice where he was, and there was nothing we could do. You know, he was under heavy morphine, he was in and out of consciousness, and the only thing we could do is just sit there, just be with him. But I felt that was doing something, just in a way honoring our friendship, honoring his life as long as he was alive. So he was just being there. But he was being there in a, one could say, non-active way. But that's also doing something. And all the time we can transform things. We can look at what are the conditions and how can I change the condition, inner condition or outer condition. Once I had a friend, she really hated a job working for a newspaper. So she decided to become a Montessori teacher. So every year I would see her and she was, you know, working on becoming a Montessori teacher because her job at the newspaper was so terrible, was awful. So after 4 or 5 years, I thought, oh, this time I'm going to go there and she's going to be a Montessori teacher now. So I said, oh, how is it going in the school? She said, oh, I am still in the newspaper. I said, what happened? And she said, oh, one day I decided to look at it differently. And instead of going, saying, I hate this job, I hate this job, I hate this job, I thought, okay, how can I be in this environment? How can I look at the people and be with the people in a way which would work? And it totally transformed the way she was in it. And she was able to do it in a very different way. So sometimes, in a way, the transformation is looking at our inner conditions. And sometimes the transformation is actually changing the condition in which we find ourselves. That if we are in a very, very difficult circumstances, then we have to do something. To, for example, with the battered women I was working with, they had to get out. They had to decide to get out because it was too terrible, too dangerous, too aggressive, too painful. But in a way, they had to find the courage to get out instead of kind of staying there. So in a way, sometimes you change inside and sometimes you change outside. So to see that the five aggregates is us in the world. It's not reducing ourselves to just this body and this mind and this feeling, but is in a way us in relationship to the world. And how that, in a way, comes together and occur and happen. And then you have the three characteristics. And to me, this is in a way one of the key to the path, this knowledge and vision of the three characteristics of impermanence, of dukkha, of anatta. And I think what we have to see that this knowledge and vision is not so much an abstract intellectual way of looking at it, but actually it's really penetrating in the experience and knowing it in the experience. So it's a knowledge which is experiential. And to me, I would say that when we really know it, and I think that's why a lot of the meditation is about that, to look deeply, to really use a vipassana, to look deeply and to experience it within ourselves, to really know it for ourselves, like in our atoms, in our molecule, in our whole body and mind. And once we know that, what is interesting with that knowledge and vision is that then, out of that, arise compassion. And so what arises is not what I call floating about. Because I think, to me, the problem with equanimity is often the way we view equanimity is to be above something. That one day, if I meditate long enough, I will be really above anything. And nothing will disturb me. Nothing will attain me. I will be on my little clouds and whatever happens, never mind. I am equanimous. But to me, that's not what equanimity is about. And that's why I want to call it creative equanimity. That actually creative equanimity is enabling us to creatively engage with wisdom and compassion to our circumstances, to our condition, to the world. And so I think that each time we really understand it, often we have actually, instead of having this transcendent feeling, I am above it, actually what we have is a compassionate feeling, a feeling of compassion for ourselves and for others. Let's take impermanence. And I think we have to be careful with impermanence because often, especially in Buddhist circle, and I would say especially in Theravada Buddhist circle, that yes, everything is impermanent. Who cares? You know? I break the vase. Who cares? It's impermanent, especially if it's not mine. It's impermanent. But I think this, in a way, is then using impermanence just as fate. It does not, I don't think it's very constructive. I don't think it's very creative. But to really know impermanence is, as my teacher used to say, is to know that your life rests upon a single breath. And when you know that, you look at yourself, you look at people in a different way. Because if you know that your life is fragile, that in a way, as Stephen was saying yesterday, we might die any moment. Then it puts things in perspective. And to me, from that, you have wisdom of what is important and what is not. Like if you have some difficulty with somebody, my test is, if I die tomorrow, would I still talk about it? And if it's somebody not washing their cups, who cares? To wash it myself will last 30 seconds. To talk about them washing it will last an hour and more. And I think it's better that I do it. But if they're aggressive or they're difficult in any way, then yes, I want to address the situation. So I think it's really, in a way, knowing this ultimate impermanence leads to this knowing, in a way, what is important, what is not. But also it's arising this compassion for this life that is fleeting. And then it helps us to look beyond. Because often we look at ourselves and others from all these ideas we have about ourselves. And instead to see, I am this human being. This person is a human being. And their life rests upon a single breath. And then you can go out of the role you have in connection to that person and to see them as human beings. And that's really what I found, in a way, for me, with my mother, when I really started to see her that way, and how much it changed my relationship to her. You have another aspect of impermanence, which is what I call the gift of impermanence, is the fact that things change, which means there is a potential for change. Doesn't mean that you will change fast, but things can change. You can change. And to me, this is one of the most uncompassionate things we can do, is to say about ourselves or other, you will never change. You will always be the same. I will always be like this. You will always be like this. What are you saying when you say that? You are basically saying that every second, every minute, every hour, every day, every month, etc., etc., forever after, you will be like this. Nobody can do it, even if they try. Nobody can do it. Because things change. Because they cannot maintain themselves in that state like that. And in a way, this is why, in a way, we evolve. Because things have to remain relatively the same a bit, and relatively changing a bit, for life to evolve. So in a way, it's a gift of change. To when you see somebody stuck, or when you see yourself stuck, to know, maybe I am stuck now. But it does not mean I will be stuck forever after. If I were more to engage in the condition where I'm stuck, then possibly I could become unstuck. And that's what I have seen again and again in my practice, in my life, is that when I find myself stuck, I think, wait a minute, what happened? What's going on here? And so in a way, to learn from those difficulties, to learn from this mistake. Recently, I had a very interesting experience. We went shopping with my mother. Everything went according to plan. We got her lots of things, etc., etc. She's 85. She rarely goes shopping. And we came back home. But if we do too much things, she's getting a little old, and so too much thing, and she get a little, you know, she can't handle it. But instead of saying, okay, we finish this, let it be, put the thing here, and then we'll take care of what we bought later, I decided to change everything in a wardrobe and organize things, and poor thing, she really got lost. And I got lost a bit. But what was interesting is, from a very pleasant feeling tone, I moved to a quite unpleasant feeling too, which then started to go in many other places. And I thought, wait a minute, what's going on here? And so the thing was that, oh, I'm not always like this. I'm actually relatively rarely like this. That's why it was so interesting to think, oh, wait a minute, what happened? How am I being influenced by this unpleasant feeling too? What is it kind of starting to rise up? How can I creatively engage with that? And actually, it was a great learning experience. So in a way, to see, to kind of really engage, because as soon as you say, that's the way it is, then you give up, in a way. Instead of, oh, what is going on? And it really becomes interesting. Even something which is difficult becomes interesting. Because you can see its changing nature. And you can also see how you can affect sometimes its tender nature. Then you have dukkha. And so dukkha, Stephen talked to you a lot about it, so I'll bring a little my idea about it. So I think first it's important to see that dukkha has three different meanings: unsatisfactory, unreliable, and dukkha-dukkha, which is suffering. And so, unsatisfactory, the Buddha is not saying everything is unsatisfactory all the time. He's just basically saying we cannot find lasting satisfaction. That's all he's saying. And what is interesting to see is how we're addicted to the hope that something will do it. At some point, we'll find something which will give us lasting satisfaction, and then we'll be sorted. And then you get it, the car, the job, the partner, and how long does it last? Not very long, generally. I mean, you can still appreciate it, but it generally did not change your life as much as you thought it would. I had a friend who really wanted to have a child. He was kind of, you know, getting on a bit, not too much, but a little. And he wanted to have a child. His life would not be fulfilled if he did not have a child. So he managed to convince his wife, who was not keen. But finally she, okay, let's have the child, but you take care of the child. And there were certain conditions. And he was telling me, I'm going to have that child. It's going to be fantastic. It's going to change my life, etc., etc. I was saying to him, be careful. I did not want to, you know, downplay it too much, but to say, just be careful, you know. It might not change everything as much as you think it might. And then some years later, I saw him again. I said, how was it? He said, yes, indeed. It's nice, but it's not like I thought it would be. And often I find it's not so much the thing itself, it's that we seem to be addicted to the hope that something do it. And so the Buddha, that's all he's pointing at. He's pointing out, be careful. You will not find lasting satisfaction. Yes, of course you can be contented. You can appreciate, you can be happy with the thing. But that, because it's impermanent, will not last in that form. Then because of that, it's unreliable. And to me, unreliability, I think, is very interesting. Especially living in the modern world. When I lived in Korea for 10 years, and at the beginning, the temple was very poor in the 70s. And so things really were not reliable. The water, the electricity, the telephone, it was really unreliable. And so, but what was good is that we really were. It was fine that it was unreliable. We creatively engaged with unreliability. We were happy when the water worked, and we went down the well if the water did not work and we had to do something in the well or whatever it was. And when I came back to the West, I came back to Europe, for a few months, I was so amazed. You press a button, it works. You open the tap, it works. And it works relatively continually. But then you get used to that. And from that you assume it will always work. And then when it doesn't work, you get very upset. No electricity, this is terrible, this is awful. And you get really so, and in a way we become so used to continuity. And of course something, impermanence doesn't say everything change every 2 minutes. There is a certain continuity. But within that there can be some change. Once we had this huge storm in France, really, I mean, I was not there. I was in England, fine, electricity, everything. But Stephen was in France with my mother and grandma, which was good. And there was the storm of all storm. So no electricity for a week. And Stephen enjoyed it so much. It was so quiet, you know. And we had some gas, and so, you know, he could, and a bit of wood, so we could keep a grandma and my mother a bit warm enough. But it's just interesting how we expect it. And the more we expect it to be reliable, the more we're going to have trouble when it is not reliable. So again, the Buddha is not saying everything change every 2 minutes, but it can change so that we are used to that. We are ready for that in a way. And then the last one is dukkha dukkha. And dukkha dukkha is basically about the suffering that we can experience. It doesn't mean that we have to be very careful, that everything is suffering all the time, that we are doomed. This is sometimes the trouble with the Theravada tradition. If I meet somebody who talks to me a lot about suffering, I think, oh, they must have done a retreat with monks. I need to lighten them up a little. Of course there is suffering. And I think we need to really engage with suffering, to creatively engage with suffering. Because I think it's through that that we really arise compassion. Because suffering, with suffering we can learn two things. which give rise to compassion. And it's a fact that suffering is painful. And secondly, it's isolating. Nobody can experience our suffering for us. Only us will experience that suffering. And so is to really know that. So the Buddha is not saying, have more suffering, you will enjoy it. But he's saying, no suffering, because if you know suffering, you will have compassion for yourself when you're suffering. Because sometimes we can be really hard on ourselves when we're suffering. I should not be like this. I should be able to do this. But when I travel, I get really... When I'm traveling, it's fine, generally. But when I go home, I really... For maybe, depending on how much I've traveled, it will be from 3 days to a week. I am just a vegetable. I really have no energy whatsoever. And before, I used to tell myself, you come back, and the next day, you start the book, you do this, you do that, you do that. And it never happened. Then I thought, well, maybe I should adapt to the condition. I don't have energy. Okay, I don't do anything. I do the minimum I can. And so I just wait for it to change. And then one day, and it's very interesting, from one moment to the next, I feel different. I feel full of energy, and then I do what I can do with that amount of energy. So I think to me this is, in a way, knowing suffering is having compassion for ourselves and others because of the knowledge and vision of conditionality. That's a key here, that we're not always suffering, we're not always like this, they're not always like that. But within those conditions, then that's how it's going to be. And so how can we be with that? How can we have compassion for those conditions? Then you have anatta. And anatta is not self, meaning not self. But I think it's very important to see, it doesn't mean that there is nothing. It doesn't mean that we're trying to get rid of ourselves, or that we're trying to become robots. I think, on the contrary, this not self, as Stephen must have mentioned it, makes us more who we can be. So not self is basically saying we cannot reduce ourselves to any one element. And again, I come back to that we so often do this. And whenever we do this, we reduce ourselves, and it's so painful. How does it feel when we reduce ourselves to a thought? When you think, I am hopeless, then like everything stops. You become paralyzed. Or if you reduce yourself to the feeling, I am angry, I'm going to get that person. And then you say the most cutting thing you can think of. And then you regret it for the next 10 years. But in a way to see that whatever arises is within a matrix of conditions, that we are a flow of conditions, that even if we have a difficult thought, feeling, sensation, or whatever it is, we are more than that. That is what anatta is saying. We are more than just any one thing of the condition that forms us. So we are this flow of condition, inner condition meeting outer condition. And so the practice, to me, that's what's fun about it. Because it's an exploration of condition. Because we realize. Because often people, as I said, think that equanimity is one day I will be above condition. And some people sell you that. If you do this practice or that practice, you'll be in this amazing state. You know, number 25 state, and you know, you will be above it all. But I don't think that's the way it is. I mean, recently I thought it was wonderful, though it was sad. There was this kind of discussion on a forum I was associated with, and there was this fellow saying, "Oh, doing that practice, I had union with the universe. I felt so amazing, at one, beyond everything. It was so good. But recently, my girlfriend left me and I feel awful. So obviously, I mean, he could go up there, but when he was down here, things were not the same. And so I think, in a way, that's why I think it's so important to, in a way, relate to condition, to look at the condition, to explore the condition. But of course, I think we have to be careful here that we cannot always know all the conditions. And sometimes you can know, oh yeah, I feel like this, I have that thought because of this. And sometimes you have no idea. Nothing happened. You know, once I was got up and I felt really weird. Funny feeling. Gray feeling. And I thought, what's that? And I looked, there was no reason that I could see for it. And I thought, oh, that's the way it is. And it continued for a few days until it went. And so to me, the creative equanimity is actually being able to see, okay, that's what's going on right now. I don't know why, but I can be with this. I did not stop me from working or doing whatever I did. And time to time I would check, oh yes, still there. Never mind, continue. So it was not very pleasant, but it was okay, I could be with it until it went of its own. And so that's what to me the creative equanimity is about. That, oh, that's a condition. Sometimes we can know them, sometimes we cannot. So I think we have to be careful. This is not necessarily a recipe for explanation of all the conditions. Some yes, some not. But it's still a part of mystery, why things happen. So this is what I wanted to say in terms of this Yatha Bhuta Jnana Dasana, this revelation and creative equanimity. And so first, what I like us to do in terms of this creative equanimity is actually to cultivate the breath, to just do a breath meditation. And then the next time I will give some instruction, I want to look at the equanimity phrases, because I think they're also very interesting. And I would put being aware of the breath also with the equanimity phrases. But let's do the breath, because most of you might be familiar with the breath. So if we can just stand up.